Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really interesting legal question that you've probably considered, especially if you've ever bought something that turned out to be, well, a dud. We're diving into McCullough v. Bilswad Chrysler Plymouth, Inc. It's a 1983 Ohio Supreme Court case. On the surface, yeah, it's about a car, but at its heart, it grapples with this fundamental issue. If you buy a faulty product, can you try to return it and, you know, still use it while you're waiting for the seller to take it back?
Right. It sounds like you shouldn't be able to, maybe.
Exactly. So stick with us, because the nuances here are surprisingly relevant, particularly if you're navigating the intricacies of contract law.
Exactly. This deep dive isn't just some dusty old case. It sets some really important precedents regarding the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC, and a buyer's right to revoke acceptance of defective goods. We've gathered a pretty comprehensive set of materials for this discussion. We've got outlines highlighting the core arguments, detailed and concise case briefs offering different perspectives, and even a perplexity analysis that really breaks down the foundational UCC principles at play here.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so our goal is to give you a clear understanding of what happened in this case, why the court ruled the way it did, and what the lasting implications are, especially when it comes to understanding your rights as a purchaser.
So our mission then is to unpack the concept of revoking acceptance under the UCC. What does it really mean to say, I'm giving this back? And then get into this potentially tricky area of what constitutes reasonable use of a product after you've tried to return it.
That's the key phrase, reasonable use.
Right. By the end of this, you should have a solid grasp of both the practical and the theoretical aspects of this area of commercial law. Okay, let's get into the story, because it's a bit of a classic David versus Goliath scenario in a way.
It really is. At the center of it all is Deborah McCullough. Back in 1978, she bought a brand new Chrysler LeBaron. You can imagine the excitement, right? That new car feeling, all the possibilities.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for her, that initial thrill didn't last very long at all.
Almost immediately, the car started having just a string of problems. And we're not talking about like a minor issue here or there.
No, not rattles and squeaks.
No. The sources detail problems with the brakes. I mean, that's a pretty critical safety feature, right?
Absolutely.
Then there were issues with the transmission, the air conditioning wasn't working properly, and there were even cosmetic flaws. It just sounds like the car was plagued with problems from the get-go.
Yeah.
And the really frustrating part is that Ms. McCullough kept bringing it back to Bilswad Chrysler Plymouth for repairs, you know, hoping they could sort things out, but the problems just kept recurring. You can just picture the multiple trips to the dealership, the time wasted, the growing frustration.
Oh, totally. Dealing with a car that just wasn't performing as expected.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Eventually, after repeated unsuccessful repair attempts, McCullough had enough. In January 1979, she took a really significant step and sent the dealership a formal notice of rescission.
Okay, what does that mean exactly? Rescission.
Essentially, she was saying, look, this car has substantial defects and I want to undo the purchase. I want my money back, and I'm offering to return the car as soon as you, the seller, provide me with instructions on how to do that. Now, here's where a seemingly contradictory element comes into play, and this is what the court really had to wrestle with.
Right, because after sending that notice, that clear signal that she wanted to return the car, McCullough kept driving it.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just, you know, a few short trips around the block. We're talking about her putting an additional 23,000 miles on the odometer after she had formally requested to return it.
23,000? That's a lot of miles.
It is. And by the time the case actually went to trial, that number had climbed to nearly 35,000 miles driven since the revocation notice. So the really obvious question, and I'm sure it's what everyone's thinking too, doesn't driving the car that much after saying you want to return it completely undermine her claim? It's like saying you want to return, I don't know, a broken washing machine, but you keep doing laundry with it.
Exactly. That's the absolute crux of the legal issue here. The Ohio Supreme Court had to determine whether McCullough's continued use of the allegedly defective Chrysler LeBaron, after she had attempted to revoke her acceptance of it, legally invalidated that revocation under the specific provisions of the Uniform Commercial Code, particularly Section 2608.
It seems counterintuitive, doesn't it?
It really does. You declare you want to return something because it's faulty, yet you continue to operate it for a significant period in mileage. Seems like you accepted it again, maybe?
Yeah, or waived your rights somehow. Yeah. Okay, so what was the Ohio Supreme Court's reasoning? How do they possibly reconcile this seemingly contradictory behavior with the idea of revoking acceptance?
Well, they ultimately affirmed the decisions of the lower courts, ruling in favor of Deborah McCullough.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, they concluded that her continued use of the vehicle did not automatically negate her revocation of acceptance. Now, to understand this seemingly unexpected outcome, we need to understand two key interconnected legal concepts that the court focused on. The first is substantial impairment.
Substantial impairment.
Right. Under the UCC, a buyer can only revoke acceptance of goods if the nonconformity, the defect or defects, substantially impairs the value of the goods to the buyer.
Okay, let's dig a little deeper into substantial impairment. It sounds like it could be interpreted in different ways. Is it purely about like the cost of repair, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, good question. The court made it really clear that substantial impairment goes beyond just the monetary cost of fixing the defects. It also encompasses the impact of those defects on the buyer's specific needs and circumstances.
Ah, the subjective part.
Exactly. In McCullough's situation, she bought a new car expecting reliable and safe transportation. The persistent issues with critical systems like the brakes and transmission, along with the repeated failures of the dealership to effectively repair these problems, significantly undermined her confidence in the vehicle's safety and dependability.
Which makes total sense.
Right. Therefore, the court determined that these repeated defects did, in fact, substantially impair the car's value to her. This subjective element, considering the buyer's perspective and intended use, is a really important aspect of this concept.
So it's not just, is the car generally worth less, but is it worth significantly less for this person's needs?
Precisely. To build on that, while the defects must be significant, the court importantly considers their impact on this specific buyer. So, you know, while a minor cosmetic issue might not be substantially impairing for one person, maybe a recurring software glitch could be for someone who relies heavily on that software for their job.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so the court agreed that the defects were significant enough to substantially impair the value of the car to Mrs. McCullough. But we still have the massive question of all those miles driven after she said she wanted to give the car back. How did the court address that?
Okay, that brings us to the second crucial legal concept, the doctrine of reasonable use after revocation.
Reasonable use, okay.
The court recognized that in certain situations, a buyer might be, well, kind of compelled to continue using defective goods even after they have attempted to revoke their acceptance. The court held that such continued use does not automatically invalidate the revocation. The absolute key is whether that use was reasonable under the specific circumstances of the case.
Okay, reasonable use. What factors did the Ohio Supreme Court weigh when determining whether McCullough's frankly extensive post-revocation driving qualified as reasonable? That seems like a high bar.
It does. But the court considered several critical factors. First and foremost was the seller's conduct. Remember, McCullough had clearly communicated her desire to return the car and had requested instructions on how to do so.
Right. She asked them what to do.
Exactly. And Bill Swad Chrysler Plymouth's failure to provide these instructions or to take any action to retrieve the vehicle was a huge factor in the court's reasoning. They essentially just left McCullough hanging in a difficult position.
So, seller in action was key. What else?
Second, the court looked at McCullough's need for transportation. It wasn't as if she had readily available alternative means of getting around. She relied on the car for essential transportation, presumably getting to work, daily life stuff.
A practical reality.
A very practical reality. Third, even after McCullough attempted to revoke, the dealership apparently continued to assure her that they would repair the vehicle and kept making attempts to do so.
Oh, interesting. So they were still kind of stringing her along.
It seems that way. And this could have reasonably led her to believe that the issue might eventually be resolved, which would necessitate continued use in the interim. The court also considered the seller's good faith, or maybe lack thereof, in handling the situation. And finally, they assessed whether McCullough's continued use had unduly prejudiced the seller. Like, did her driving it significantly further depreciate the vehicle beyond what the initial defects had already caused?
And based on all those factors, the court somehow concluded that her continued driving was, in fact, reasonable, even 35,000 miles.
Precisely. It's surprising, but the court's rationale was that McCullough was in a predicament that wasn't her fault. She was stuck with a defective car, the seller wasn't taking it back despite her asking, and she had a genuine need for transportation.
Okay.
And as the court poignantly stated, and this is a really key quote, clearly, to penalize the buyer for a predicament not of his own creation would be patently unjust.
Wow. That's pretty strong language.
It is. They essentially said she was forced into this continued use because the seller didn't cooperate with her legitimate attempt to revoke acceptance. This ruling set a precedent that acknowledged the practical realities consumers face. You could even think about today's world. Maybe with essential software or subscription services, if they are fundamentally flawed, could this reasonable use concept be extended to continued, albeit frustrated, attempts to use them while you're trying to get a refund?
That's an interesting parallel to consider. Now, the seller also argued that the limited warranty they provided was the exclusive remedy for any defects, right? How did the court respond to that?
Yeah, that's a standard argument. The court rejected that argument as well, based on the legal principle of the failure of essential purpose.
Failure of essential purpose. Okay.
So, the limited warranty promised to repair or replace any defective parts. However, the court pointed out that despite numerous attempts by the dealership, the fundamental problems with the car remained unresolved. Therefore, the limited remedy of repair and replacement failed to fulfill its essential purpose, which is, to actually provide the buyer with a car that works as intended.
Makes sense if the fix doesn't fix it.
Right. As the court rather definitively put it, clearly, the hourglass is run on appellant's efforts to place the car in good running order.
Ouch.
Yeah. So once a limited remedy fails in its essential purpose, the buyer is then entitled to pursue other remedies available under the UCC, like revocation of acceptance. The warranty doesn't shield the seller anymore.
We also saw in our source materials that Justice Holmes wrote a concurring opinion in this case. What was his perspective? Did he disagree with the outcome?
No. He agreed with the majority's conclusion that McCullough did have the right to revoke her acceptance of the vehicle. However, he raised a more nuanced point concerning all that significant mileage she accumulated after the revocation.
Ah, the miles again.
Miles again. He argued that the seller should have been given the opportunity to present evidence demonstrating that they were entitled to an offset, basically, a reduction in the refund amount owed to McCullough to account for the benefits she received from using the car during that post-revocation period.
So, like, pay for the use she got out of it.
Kind of, yeah. He believed there should be a mechanism to compensate the seller for that usage. However, the majority ultimately found that Bill Swad Chrysler Plymouth hadn't provided sufficient evidence to properly calculate the value of that post-revocation use.
So they didn't prove their damages, essentially.
That's the gist of it. Justice Holmes wasn't disagreeing with the right to revoke, but he highlighted a crucial point for balancing fairness. Should the buyer get a full refund, even if they did get some value from using the defective product after saying they wanted to return it? He felt the seller should at least have had a chance to argue for a reduction based on this usage, which, brings up interesting questions about the economic realities of these situations.
Yeah, definitely adds another layer. This might be a good point to clarify a potential area of confusion, especially for law students listening. The distinction between rejection and revocation under the UCC. They might sound similar, but occur at different stages, right?
Oh, that's a really critical distinction to nail down. Yes. Rejection occurs before a buyer formally accepts the goods. For instance, if you receive a shipment and immediately notice obvious defects upon inspection, you have the right to reject the goods right then and there.
Before you've signed off, basically.
Right. Revocation of acceptance, on the other hand, happens after the buyer has already accepted the goods. This typically occurs when the defects weren't initially apparent, or maybe if the buyer reasonably assumed the seller would be able to fix the issues later.
Like in McCullough's case.
Exactly. In McCullough's case, she initially accepted the Chrysler LeBaron. It was only after experiencing all those persistent problems and the repeated failure of repair attempts that she sought to revoke that earlier acceptance. We even looked at a perplexity analysis in our prep, which really dissected the nuances of Article 2 of the UCC to make sure we understood the foundational principles at play in this case.
Okay, so we've gone through the facts, the timeline, the court's legal reasoning, the concurrence. Let's bring it back to our listeners. Why does this 1983 Ohio Supreme Court decision in McCullough v. Built a Swad still hold significance today? Why should a law student care about this old car case?
Well, this case remains really important because it significantly reinforces consumer protections under the UCC, particularly when dealing with substantial purchases like vehicles. But the principles apply more broadly. It establishes that if you buy something with significant unfixable flaws that substantially impair its value to you, you have legal recourse beyond just endlessly trying to get it fixed.
It gives the buyer more leverage.
Definitely. And it clarifies that your right to revoke acceptance isn't necessarily just wiped out if you have to continue using the item out of necessity while waiting for the seller to actually take it back.
And it also places a clear responsibility on sellers, doesn't it? They can't just ignore a revocation attempt and hope it goes away.
Exactly right. The court's ruling underscores that sellers have a duty to act reasonably and in good faith when a buyer validly revokes acceptance. They can't just ignore the buyer's request to return the goods. They need to provide instructions for the return.
Or face consequences.
Right. If a seller wrongfully refuses to accept the return after a proper revocation, they could ultimately bear the financial burden of any subsequent decline in the item's value while it sits in the buyer's possession. As the court clearly stated, the seller must bear the risk of a subsequent decline in the resale value of the goods if they wrongfully refuse to accept return following a proper revocation. That creates a pretty strong incentive for sellers to handle these requests responsibly.
Okay, so what are the key practical takeaways for our listeners, especially those future lawyers or even just consumers who might find themselves in a similar situation with a problematic purchase?
The most critical advice, honestly, is to meticulously document everything.
Paper trail.
Huge paper trail. Keep detailed records of every single defect you experience, every communication you have with the seller, dates, times, names of people you spoke with, what was said. Crucially, if you decide to revoke your acceptance, make sure you do so clearly and in writing, stating your intention to return the goods and requesting instructions on how to proceed.
Don't just rely on phone calls.
Absolutely not. And if you have to continue using the item after attempting revocation, carefully document the reasons why maybe the seller hasn't provided return instructions, or you genuinely lack a reasonable alternative for transportation or whatever the item's function is. Thorough documentation can be absolutely invaluable if you need to assert your rights later on.
That's solid advice. So, to kind of summarize the core principle from McCullough v. Bill Swad, even if you continue to use a significantly flawed product after attempting to return it, your right to revoke acceptance might still be valid, especially if the seller isn't cooperating with the return process. But the crucial factor the courts will look at is whether your continued use was reasonable under all the circumstances.
That's a concise and accurate summary. Reasonableness is the magic word.
Yeah.
But it's judged against the backdrop of the seller's actions and the buyer's situation.
Right.
And it leads us to maybe a final point for you to consider. How might this concept of substantial impairment be applied in other contexts beyond just tangible goods like cars? Could it apply to, say, services that don't meet a certain standard? Or maybe defective software, like we touched on.
Like a constantly crashing operating system.
Perhaps. And what does reasonableness truly look like in our increasingly consumer-driven society, where we rely so heavily on the products and even digital services we purchase for our daily lives and work? It's a legal concept with implications that continue to evolve right alongside the goods and services we consume.
Definitely some important points to think about, especially as technology and commerce keep changing. Thanks for this insightful deep dive.
My pleasure. It's a fascinating case.
It really is. Until our next exploration.